It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
In 1892, a doctor in Millington was murdered. Eight African Americans were convicted of the crime. Four of them were hanged. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. It was a time of Jim Crow and lynchings, and Kevin Himstock has written about it in his new book entitled Injustice on the Eastern Shore, Race and the Hill Murder Trial. In the book, he explores how the authorities and the white and African-American communities reacted as the case went to trial. Lynching was avoided, but was a concern. And the book comes at a time when the state of Maryland has authorized a Truth and Reconciliation Commission on lynchings in the state. And we have Kevin on the phone this morning. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about it.
So describe the town of Millington at the time. What kind of town was it? What kind of race relations did it have?
We're looking at a town of about 400 people. You know, it was like the center of a farming community, so it actually drew a lot of business because the farmers would come here to do their shopping and that kind of thing. So it was primarily white. It had been incorporated in 1890, just 2 years before the murder. And one of the reasons it was incorporated was so that they could hire a policeman and that kind of thing. And one of their big concerns was black and white crime, which really wasn't that serious, but it was to the white folks here. And they incorporated in such a manner as to exclude black communities. There was a little black community abutting on the side of the town, and they intentionally excluded that in their incorporation so that it would basically be predominantly a white town. So it's kind of unfortunate that they did that. And to this day, that community still exists. It's called Sandfield, and it's still predominantly black, and it still is not part of town officially.
What kind of relationship did the white and African-American community have? I think you note in the in your book that the Justice of the Peace, William Johnson, was no friend to African-Americans. What was that relationship like? Because obviously they did have interaction in terms of business, in terms of doing things in terms of business.
Sure they did. And you know, it's sort of a parallel societies. And, I like to say that it's like everybody knew their proper place. Does that make sense? And, nobody stepped out of line in theory. Blacks didn't really shop at white stores and vice versa. There's a caveat there that's interesting, but that's probably another story. But in any case, everybody knew what their proper place was. It doesn't mean that blacks didn't work in town. I mean, there were a lot of laborers, and of course, the suspects in this case were, just what they called peach pickers, and they would, labor on the white farms primarily. So, I mean, it was just an understood relationship that you didn't step out of bounds.
Now, the incident that seems to spark everything is this collection of a debt in 1891. Describe for me the individuals involved and the altercation that resulted in one death.
Well, we had a black man from Sandfield, which was a abutting community, who hired a white man to do some carpentry work. And the white guy wanted his money, and he wanted his money right away. Well, the black man, John Potts, thought that he could pay over time, in installments, because he didn't have a lot of money. And it just grew into a confrontation at a bar on Christmas Eve, 1891. And, John Potts and his brother got some friends, including a guy named Campbell, and they went to the bar where the carpenter was playing cards with his buddies. Everybody knew this was going to happen, and it turned into a confrontation, and this guy Campbell was essentially murdered by the whites that were there playing cards. And, that's all well and good. That's fine, So there was an inquest, and Dr. Hill, who was later the murder victim, he judged that this guy, he claimed this guy died of a heart attack. Well, that's absurd. Of course, they kicked him to death is what they did. And, the black community was incensed, and it led to that, that fateful night on April 23rd, 1892, where Dr. James High Hill was attacked by eight or nine black men and boys. And you know, from there, that's how it all got rolling.
By the way, is there
two murders? Yeah. You're looking at two murders.
Yeah. I mean, is there any indications to what Hill's relationship was to the African American community at any time, or?
Well, interestingly enough, Hill was a, you know, he would actually serve the black community as well as the white, and that wasn't, you know, that didn't happen all the time. Some doctors just refused to work, white doctors refused to work on, you know, black blacks. But he wouldn't help blacks, and that's fine. So he had a, you know, prior to the incident at the bar, Christmas Eve 1891, he had a pretty good relationship with the blacks.
So then describe for me the events that occur on April 23rd, 1892, when James Hill is gets a message, apparently, from James Shaw's daughter that she's sick. Describe for me then what happened.
Okay, well, Dr. Hill was attending a political rally because it was the, you know, we were going through the campaign of Grover Cleveland for president, and he was a supporter, and they had a rally at across from Hill's residence. And while he was at the rally, his assistant, you know, came to him and said, you know, the Shaws need your help up here in Massey. Of course, Massey was 4 miles north of Millington. And, you know, back then, doctors made house calls, of course. And so sure enough, he, you know, loaded up his what they call the dog cart, which is a two-wheeled, you know, passenger wagon. And he started for Massey to go visit the Shaw family. And he got about three-quarters of a mile north of Millington, where he was met by eight or nine black men and boys. And these black kids and men held him responsible for basically lying on the autopsy. They felt he lied on the autopsy. I'm convinced he did lie on the autopsy personally, but I couldn't get, you know, I couldn't find that smoking gun, as it were. But and they stopped him and grabbed him and pummeled him with a large rock, hit him in the head multiple times and made him unconscious. And, you know, then they spooked the horse, and the horse went all the way to Massey. The horse actually went where he was supposed to go and then stopped there and rested for a little while and turned around and came back. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, the horse ended up, you know, at his house, and his wife found him out there, you know, kind of scrunched into this dog cart, oddly, because the, you know, the suspects had just, you know, really manipulated his body into this cart so that he wouldn't fall out. And, you know, his wife saw that. She went crazy, notified the neighbors, and you know, and then they summoned the doctors, but he, you know, they didn't do any good. He never regained consciousness, and he died later that next day, which is a Sunday, April 23rd, or excuse me, make sure I don't get my dates wrong. April 24th, excuse me. He died on April 24th. So
now, one of the key figure in all of this, it seems to be, is Fletcher Williams. And Chuck Brooks obviously participated in what appears to be at least the wounds that were inflicted that led to Hill's death. Tell me a little bit about that relationship. What happened that night in terms of what Williams did and where the others were in relationship to what was going on?
Well, you essentially had three adults there. You had Fletcher Williams, Moses Brown, and Charles Brooks. And these other kids were just kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time. They're just kind of hanging out. They probably didn't expect any of this sort of thing to happen. They probably didn't know it. They were just basically out hanging out with these adults. Now, these three, it would seem, knew that Hill was going to the Shaws, and that's because they'd been spying on him that day. One of them, John Potts, who was never convicted, by the way, had been seen peeking through the window at that political rally and may have heard, you know, that Hill's assistant tell him that the Shaws needed it. So consequently, they knew that somehow that Hill was going to be going north of Massey. We're talking about 9 o'clock at night. It's amazing that they were there at the same time. So we know pretty much that they knew that he was coming. So the three adults probably, you know, made this all go down. The other five, basically the kids, the teenagers, I don't think they knew what was going to happen, and they were just under pressure from the adults to participate. And they even, you know, at the time of the assault, the three adults, you know, told the others to do something so that they would be invested in this homicide. And so consequently, that's how they got involved.
So how did they come about that, the authorities, after sort of tracking up and down, trying to figure out what happened in terms of certainly the route that that Hill took, how did they come to the conclusion that these were the people who had committed the murder?
Well, the justice of the peace in town was William Johnson. In fact, it was his office where they had the political rally. Anyway, on the morning that Hill was being tended by the doctors, William Johnson and another man followed. They could see the tracks of the cart. They could see where the assault took place, and they just followed. They followed the tracks all the way to Madison. They could see blood, things like that. Along the way, at some point, they even ran into Fletcher Williams. I think it was Fletcher Williams, and he had a hat. He had Hill's hat, and that kind of, they came back, and a couple others followed the tracks and did some stuff. And of course, at that point, the sheriff was involved, and so consequently, they had Fletcher Williams. They were looking at him. And then they came across, some of his friends who were also involved. And then they came across Perry Bradshaw. I think it was Perry Bradshaw or Baynard, who someone else had said he told them about this fight that took place. And so one thing led to another where they got the group of suspects. And actually, when it was all said and done, they probably had about 20 suspects that they rounded up. And that's because some new things that, some will be in cagey. And they, ultimately, good police work, even back in 1892, they worked on these 9 suspects and finally got the story. They got the one of them turned state's evidence, and that was Perry Bradshaw. And so he wasn't charged. He was involved, but he wasn't charged. So that's our ninth guy that was involved. And they think that John Potts was involved, but they could never place him at the scene, so. Out of the 8 or 9 or 10 of them, they ultimately charged 8 of them.
So one of the things that struck me is that there was a great concern after their arrest that there could be a possible lynching. Describe the efforts that were made and the fact that they were sort of coming off in many ways of 2 recent lynchings.
Well, it was pretty wild stuff there. Obviously, the white community was incensed. You had these just, to them, they were low-life laborers who killed a prominent, young, happy doctor. The doctor his wife had just had a baby. So there was just a lot of, emotion going on in the predominant white community. And so needless to say, it was not uncommon for lynchings to take place. Now, there was only one lynching in Kent County that I've ever found. But there were a couple in Queen Anne's County, which is, the county on the south side. There's the one in Cecil County. I mean, they were going on during this period, and so there was that kind of sentiment. And in fact, the sheriff got word that a crowd was going to come to jail, one night soon after these arrests, and lynch the parties involved. And so he actually spirited away a couple of the suspects, the adult suspects, because he thought, a lynching was imminent. Sure enough, a crowd of whites, angry white farmer types and that kind of thing showed up with, blazing firebrands and pitchforks and the whole bit, and got into the jail. They were actually allowed to come into the jail because the suspects were not there. And so they went through the jail looking for them, decided, that they weren't there, and so they were, the lynching was, didn't happen. But there was a lot of passion. Ironically, the murder was in April. The following month, there was another crime where a black man was, charged with rape of a little white girl. He was put in the jail with these suspects. And that did lead to a lynching. He was hauled out of there and hung across the street. Had nothing at all to do with this murder, but you can see the passion and the anger that was the community was under. And so consequently, there was a lynching there. When this other guy was lynched, they actually took some of the Hill suspects and got them out of there because they thought that they might be confused with the guy who did, you know, who was charged with rape. So, I mean, it was just a boiling cauldron of you know, anger and you know, on both sides of the, you know, the racial spectrum. The African American community was they were concerned, you know, that this would, you know, put a bad light on them. And they actually, you know, some of the local black leaders, you know, declared that they would have nothing to do with the suspects in this case. I mean, it was just talk about a racial quagmire. This was it right here.
Yeah, it was really interesting because they sort of issued this statement, which includes that they applauded the fact that there wasn't a lynching, amongst other things. But at the same time, they seem to be trying to create this distance between themselves and the alleged perpetrators.
Sure, and that really shouldn't be surprising, whatever the race is. You don't want to, you know, if you're a church-going community, you don't want to be associated with a heinous crime. And white or black, I mean, it doesn't matter what color you are. So it's not surprising, and you know, it's just, it was an unfortunate period of time when you know, it would be difficult for any blacks accused of any crime to get a decent trial. You got to remember, there were no black juries, there were no black judges, there was no black law enforcement. I mean, it's all white, and you know, you couldn't bypass the racial bias. You just couldn't, no matter what. And so, you know, there was just a lot of racial tension.
So, in terms of the situation with these defendants, one of the things that did happen was that John Potts, in the end, was let go. What was the reaction to that, and why was it they were not able to connect him to this particular murder?
Well, John and his brother, they couldn't place either one of them at the crime scene, which was the assault. And they just couldn't. And the guy who turned state's evidence, Perry Bradshaw, he didn't place Potts at the crime scene. Now, clearly Potts was, I shouldn't say clearly, but one witness said they saw Potts watching Hill when he was at that political rally. But that doesn't, you know, that doesn't mean he committed crime. And needless to say, the white community was still incensed that Potts got off. Now, as soon as Potts was acquitted, the judge and the sheriff helped him get a ticket the heck out of of the community, because they thought he was going to be lynched too. And I think I found a later reference to him in the 1900 census, but I'm not 100% sure. The reasonably common name, but I think he moved to Philadelphia ultimately.
So what were the confessions that then really kind of nailed this into the coffin in terms of the trial that was submitted and how people knew what was going on? What were the key confessions here?
Perry Bradshaw, he turned state's evidence, and Josh Baynard. Also, you know, he lied and kind of, you know, quibbled on some of the aspects, but he also gave the sheriff a lot of evidence, and as a consequence, they were able to piece the story together from other, you know, other witness accounts as well. And so that's really what did it. Kurt Bradshaw is interesting because, you know, you would say he was never charged, and they, you know, he eventually did leave the area too. But the irony is, when this book was first published, I had somebody come into the little shop I had where I used to sell antiques, and he is a wonderful African American man, and he slammed the book down on the counter, and I thought, uh-oh, we've got a problem here. And he looked up at me, and he said, "This is the second best book I've ever read." He said, the first being the Bible. He said, "Because Perry Bradshaw was my ancestor, and you got everything right about the account, about his genealogy and all that stuff like that." And so I was, I thought that was pretty interesting. And of course, the book's already published, but he gave me a lot more information. Actually gave me, I had some interesting pictures from him. But, you know, so it's kind of gratifying when that happens, when someone, you know, he was a descendant of one of the perpetrators, and he thought it was a great representation of what went on and what he knew about. So,
So in terms of the defendants, as they were going through this trial process, what was their demeanor like? And you seem to indicate that at least particularly the younger ones did not necessarily have a full grasp of what was taking place in front of them.
They didn't understand the process. They didn't understand the legal process. They really didn't understand their crime or what they were being charged with. And they certainly didn't understand what the ultimate penalty would be if they were found guilty. You know, it's like when the judge issued the verdict. There were three judges actually, and then chief judge issued the verdict. They really didn't understand it, and of course the adults did. They knew it was probably the end of their lives. They were going to hang for it. So consequently, the youngsters. I think one of them might have been Frisbee Comedies, said, okay, so when are we going to go home now? There was no way he could grasp that, and I don't know whether it was an intelligence issue on his part or just a misunderstanding of, you know, the system, as it were. You got to remember, you know, area blacks avoided the legal system because it was a white-driven system. They didn't trust it. You know, their system was church-driven. You know, that's where, you know, they did a lot of their business, and they, you know, stayed within the confines of their community, and they didn't trust, and they didn't understand the white legal system or anything that went along with it. So unless they had to be involved in it for one reason or the other, maybe to get a license or to do something or whatever, get a permit or something, a building permit or whatever it might have been, you know, that's the only time they would get involved in that system. And so consequently, there was just a lack of understanding about what all of this meant. The truth of it is, back then, I don't know if you caught this, but, you know, if you were convicted of first-degree murder, there was only one sentence. The judges didn't have any option. The sentence was death, unless it was commuted by the governor. In this particular case, all eight alleged perpetrators were sentenced to death, and the governor, of course, Governor Farmer Brown, he commuted the sentence of the four youngest ones. And commuted it to life in prison. Of course, I'm sure you noted that that life didn't last very long in prison.
About 7 years.
Prison wasn't a nice place for certainly not for teenagers.
So, and speaking to the governor, as a matter of fact, because he makes a surprise visit. Tell me about the visit, and then ultimately the rationale for why he decided to make those four in particular commuted to life.
Well, I think the governor had a lot of integrity, and, you know, you always hear about, you know, politicians in that area being crooked, but I think that's why this guy here, Governor Brown, he had a lot of integrity. He only served one term, which may be because he had a lot of integrity, I'm just saying, but he really toiled over this. There's a lot of hand-wringing over this case because he was getting communication from African American leaders in Baltimore. He actually got communication from the wife of Dr. Hill, you know, telling him that, well, these guys have been charged, convicted, and sentenced, and that shouldn't be changed because it was a strong move to get the young ones, give them a life sentence versus death. And at that, there was a point at which he decided he was going to come to town himself. You got to understand, we don't see the governor in Kent County very often. So even back then, it was quite a shock when, you know, he showed up at the sheriff's house, and, you know, the sheriff and the jail, you know, they were connected. So you can imagine his shock when he knocked on the door and said, I want to talk to all of them. And he decided ultimately that four of them shouldn't have commuted sentences, the youngest ones. Now, the one that he didn't, whose sentence he didn't commute, who was also very young, was Frisbee Comedies. And I got from that in his interview of Comedies that he just got a bad vibe. For some reason, Comedies was a smart aleck or something like that. And because Comedies was just as young as the other four youngsters and maybe even younger. I think he's like 14 or 15. But, you know, so that the governor just got a bad vibe with him, so he got stuck with the adults and, you know, in the capital punishment.
Now, tell me, describe for a bit about the hanging. And one of the things that struck me, and I did not realize this, was that these hangings, they took, and the executions for that matter, took place actually in the localities where these events occur. It wasn't until later, actually, that they moved them to the penitentiary. Tell me a little bit about this, because it's almost a certain circus quality to this event.
Yeah, and, you know, it's always been so since the dawn of English law. You know, this, the public, governments have thought that, the public needs to see it, to see that justice has been done. By the time that these guys were hanged, these four were hanged, they wanted to make sure the public knew that they were hanged to get executed and punished for their crimes, but they didn't want the public to be close enough that they could see it and, see the grisly action. So they actually made a good effort to try to obscure the hanging site. It was outside the courthouse, but they built a fence around, the property, and then they built a little kind of obscuring wooden screen kind of thing to actually prevent people from actually seeing the hanging. You can imagine, of course, the scaffolding was built for eight because the sheriff didn't know until towards the end that, that four would be commuted. So it's pretty big scaffolding. And but still in all, it was a four person hanging, pretty spectacular from the, sensation side. And even though the weather was awful, I mean, it was, January 13th, Friday the 13th, by the way, that this hanging took place. It was snowy, it was cold, but there were still a lot of people showed up. And I don't know whether you'd say it was hundreds or thousands, who knows, but, hanging was supposed to take place at noon, so it was a little late, so people getting anxious, and some of the rowdier members of the crowd started to bust through the fence. And some of them actually got in the yard, and when the hanging took place, there was actually people touching the bodies, and the hanging bodies and stuff. It was a grisly affair. It wasn't a pretty hanging. Hangings generally wouldn't be anyway, but this one was particularly awful because Frisbee Commagees didn't die right away, and he, if you can imagine, he danced around under the rope for probably 5-10 minutes, and you can imagine. That was a million lifetimes for that poor kid. It was just not a pretty thing.
Now, one of the things, by the way, that struck me is that despite all of the confessions and so on, that when they were asked, particularly by the governor, did you do it, they all seemed to be saying, or most of them anyway, seemed to be saying, deny that they did it and that they were innocent. What are we to make of that?
Well, last word that was said by these suspects was that you're hanging an innocent man. But I wasn't surprised by that because I studied some other executions, and one of the most famous ones in Kent County was the Causter murder in 1851. And right up to the end, those three suspects said the same thing. They were innocent. They wouldn't do anything. I'm not sure. I guess who knows what goes through the mind of someone who has to face that kind of penalty. In terms of whether they want to, say what they did, what their part was in a case like this or not, or whether they figure, gonna die anyway, might as well go shouting my innocence. Bottom line is they never did say, other than the one there, that Josh Baird. He's the one that said that, or Boehner, excuse me, he's the one that. It did actually give some information, but he did also lie about some of the aspects of it. But the others, by and large, did not confess.
Finally, you actually explored some legal questions about the trial. Tell me a little bit about those and the fact that these two defense attorneys didn't do some of the things that, as we look back now anyway, that would be done.
Well, they were white attorneys in the in the lawyer club in Kent County at the time. Basically, they were prominent attorneys, and they were put on the case to mollify the white community, essentially. I talked to modern-day lawyers, and it's interesting to note that, this case here, it's like you would never, ever try nine people in one trial for murder. I mean, that wouldn't happen. That would be considered malpractice, legal malpractice. So, I mean, there was just a lot of things in this that's, you know, hence the word injustice, and that's where the word injustice comes. You know, in this day and age, you know, those five kids would never have been convicted of murder, maybe manslaughter for their involvement or whatever, but they would never have been convicted. They would never have been, certainly never been hanged in the case of Frisbee Comedy. So that's part of the issue there. For that period, a black man could not get a good, good, well represented in that community, in that kind of environment. Just impossible. And so, hence the word injustice. There's no doubt that, you know, the three adults were involved in this crime. I think the kids, they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. They were hanging out with what they probably thought were cool adults, and they just happened to be there when it happened. So, anyway, that's the sad part. Hopefully that's changed a little bit. You know, we hear many of cases, modern day cases that are questionable, but certainly that would never have happened. And there would have been changes of venue, I'm sure, in some of these cases. No question about it. And, sometimes that happened. You look at the cause to murder, the 1851 cause to murder, and there was a change of venue in two of the cases. Well, that should have happened here as well. And because obviously the community was so incensed, we really couldn't have gotten a fair trial. Needless to say, there were no blacks on the jury. Blacks were not chosen for the jury, any jury. No women on the jury, of course. Women were also excluded from juries. And so, the bottom line is, from a justice standpoint, there was no justice. It wasn't properly done by today's standards.
We've been speaking with Kevin Himstock. He has written about this murder of James Hill, the doctor, and his book entitled Injustice on the Eastern Shore, Race and the Hill Murder Trial. We appreciate you taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Well, I appreciate you having me, and I hope you enjoyed the book.
It was fascinating.
Yeah, very good.
You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening. From the music of the Andes and the Irish to the sounds of East Africa and the flair of Chinese dance, the 79th Annual National Folk Festival is announced the last of its acts for this September's event. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Thousands are expected in September to attend the National Folk Festival that enters its second year in Salisbury. The festival will highlight over 350 artists, including musicians, dancers, storytellers, and craftspeople. In addition, there are more than 35 groups performing at 7 outdoor venues. This morning, we're going to focus on the last of the announced acts. Our guests are Caroline O'Hare, she's the local manager for the festival, and Blaine Wade, he is associate director for the National Council for the Traditional Arts. And welcome to the program.
Good morning.
So I want to first turn to you, Caroline, and give us a little update about what's been going on. I understand you're carrying around some buckets or something like that. And go ahead.
I'm headed to the hardware store to pick up a bunch of buckets. Yes. A lot of stuff is going. Everyone's wearing multiple hats. So right now, yeah, I might be doing some physical stuff to get ready for site prep. We've got our crew coming in about 2.5-3 weeks. They're going to start unloading the trailers, getting tents rolling out and all that fun stuff. We also have our volunteers, which are really kicking up, and we're getting a lot of responses. We are still looking for folks for the Bucket Brigade, which is a great volunteer role. You're basically helping fund the festival. You're helping keep the festival free. And it's a lot of fun. You get to dance around. You get to hang out with entertainers. You get to give out awesome stickers, which are great. And so if you want to volunteer for that or for numerous other things like backstage support or selling merch or helping with info booths or first aid, just go to nationalfolkfestival.com/volunteer, and you can find out all the different ways that you can help out. Volunteer like a couple hours, 3 hours here, 4 hours there, or some folks are actually volunteering the entire festival, which I am so thankful for. Thank you guys. Volunteers are the backbone of this festival. They're the reason why this festival is amazing and unique and just the best. So volunteers, we are obviously will be looking for volunteers up until the festival. We also have We have our site prep going on, and we have also our schedule. Oh, my goodness. The schedule, the actual, like, when, for example, Daryl Davis will be playing and at what time, or when you can see Sheila K. Adams or you can see Hot Club of Cowtown. That schedule should come out in the next week or so. So early to mid-August, very excited to roll that out. Then you can plan your entire festival weekend and know which stage you're going to go to. So we're looking forward to that. And then the family area. One of my favorite places. We're starting to get all the crafts and the materials for the activities and the demonstrations and all that stuff coming in. That's going to be just... it's one of my favorite places. You have families and children that get to... interact and engage and do all these fun things for free in the family area on Saturday and Sunday. So if you have a youngster, or even if you just are young at heart, come to the family area, you'll really enjoy it. So we've just got a lot of things going on. And we also just announced the final performers, which I'm really excited we're going to talk about today.
So, matter of fact, well, let's turn to that, Blaine. So let's first of all talk. We had a samba group actually out of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Tell me a little bit about them and the kind of music that they play.
Sure. So samba mapangala, actually, so samba was originally born in what is now the Democratic Republic of Congo, but we're thrilled that he, for many years now, has made his home in Jessup, Maryland. He came over to the U.S. In the mid-1990s and eventually made his way to Jessup, so it's really exciting to bring him to the National Folk Festival in Maryland to celebrate what he does, but sort of got ahead of you a bit there, backtracking. He was born at the time in Zaire, began singing in church, and then got really embedded in the vibrant music scene going on at the time at Kinshasa, the capital, and from there moves to Kenya. And what's so interesting about Samba's music is he's drawing on strands of traditional music that come from both conga and Kenya, and creating this really exciting blend of music, the real highlight of which is his high tenor voice. He's just such a beautiful singer. He's just sort of going to melt hearts at the festival.
Now, I understand that a lot of this music comes out of the 30s and 40s, sort of a mix of, say, South American, Caribbean, Afro-Cuban. Tell me a little bit about those elements.
Oh, sure, gladly. So what's happening around that time, especially in the Congo and other parts of Africa too, is a lot of the cultural, the roots, the music, the cultural traditions that had left Africa due to the horrors of the slave trade were starting and then come to the Americas, to places like Cuba and Haiti, and been nurtured and cultivated there and developed combined with some of the indigenous and Spanish and other influences that were also in the Americas. Those elements, those traditions, started to migrate back and influence music in Africa. And so what you have in the 30s and 40s is Afro-Cuban rhythms and sounds and Haitian rhythms and sounds coming back and really influencing Congolese music. And what happened was the creation of what you could call African rumba, which is a nod to the Cuban influence, but which was later called soukous. And soukous really took the African continent and then really the international music stage by storm in the 1970s. And so a lot of what samba is doing, at least bringing from his Congolese heritage, is that soukous sound, which is the, other than his voice, what really is notable about that is this high, crisp, clear guitar sound from the lead guitarist that people are going to pick up on immediately, and is a really amazing element of that music. So he took that, and also once he moved to Kenya, draws on a music and dance tradition there called Dinga, which is, a tradition coming out of the Luo people and also combined with Western electric instruments. So he's weaving all of these things together with his great vocals, and so it's just such an exciting story that embedded in it is so much about the history of music, both in like the marriage of elements from the Americas and Africa.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that music. now turn to Veracruz. We got some actually folk music out of Veracruz. How does it differ than the kind of music that maybe we associate with Mexico?
Sure. So what we're talking about here is the Son Jarocho tradition, which, as you noted, Don, comes out of the state of Veracruz along Mexico's Gulf Coast. And, like every country we could ever speak of, that, there are regional styles throughout Mexico. Last year we had Mariachi Los Camperos, which is just a very large, big band that's mixing violins and strings and horns with beautiful harmony singing. Son Jarocho is, very different. It's a mix of a very strong and notable vocal tradition laid over driving, danceable rhythms played on string instruments. So to talk a little bit about the vocal tradition piece, what you have here is the group is fronted by what's called a pregonero, or a caller. And the caller notes just a vast repertoire of sones, or basically different stanzas or lyrics that the pregonero can use to improvise in the moment and construct a song. So it's very much a musical tradition born in the moment. Sometimes the pregonero may see somebody in the audience and sing a combination of sones that says, oh, I saw you here last night, and you were with a different woman, and now look who you're here with. So it's drawing on this vast repertoire of stanzas to create music that speaks to the moment. And the other members in the group, they can range from anywhere from 3 to 5. This group has 5 members, Grupo Nematetlin. And the others contribute to the vocals in a call-and-response structure, which is also distinct about this tradition. And then that's laid over or sung on top of a series of really fascinating and beautiful stringed instruments. You have the jarana, which is an 8-stringed, small-bodied guitar that really provides the distinctive musical sound of Son Jarocho paired with the distinctive vocals. And then you have the requinto jarocho, which is a 4-stringed melody guitar. And then the third and final instrument of this particular regional style is the arpa, or the harp. So you have all these wonderful elements coming together, but it's a very improvisatory music.
And she not only talks about, obviously, lost love, but also has certain historical memory, struggles for justice. What is the background on that?
Sure. I mean, this was a music that was very much born as Mexican identity was evolving, and lots of different issues are coming to the fore when the music came out. And so it's often the pregonero also is drawing on the sones and the lyrics to speak to those issues of the day, because as much as you're improvising in the moment about a social situation, you can also improvise in the moment about what else is going on in the news cycle, much like something like the plena tradition coming out of Puerto Rico. So you can construct music that speaks to the moment, more broadly speaking, than just the immediate moment. But another big piece of that is when this music was emerging, it was very much a lot going on in Mexico with cultural identity and what was Mexico going to be as an independent country, and throwing off different colonial influences. So this is a music that was closely tied to that.
Let's hear a little taste of that. I want to turn, by the way, now, you have a group, I guess, from China, or at least Chinese in terms, it's described as a Chinese silk and bamboo ensemble. What is that?
Sure. So in Chinese truth, the group, this is a group called Music from China. They're based in New York, though they bring together some of the top traditional Chinese musicians from throughout the country. But the name, to call the music Silk and Bamboo, what that means is in Chinese tradition, often a musical tradition will be named after the material out of which an instrument is made. So in this instance, silk refers to stringed instruments because historically stringed instruments in Chinese music were the strings were made out of silk. And then bamboo refers to here the one wind instrument, the ditsi or the bamboo flute, that will be played in the ensemble, and again, so it's made out of bamboo. So that name, silk and bamboo, refers to that. But it's a really traditional combination of instruments in traditional Chinese music. To see the different silk instruments, you have the erhu, which is a two-string spiked fiddle, combined with the zheng or the gozheng, which is a 21-string zither, played flat, and then a pipa, which is a pear-shaped lute, and there's one other lute rounding out the group. So that's the combination you have, and you have some amazingly virtuosic musicians who come together to perform with music from China. Wang Gouwei on the erhu, who's also the artistic director of the group, is just an absolute monster. He's going to blow people away at the festival. And then An Yao, who's on the gozheng, likewise is one of the most highly regarded young players in the United States. And the instrument she plays is one of the most ancient in Chinese music history. It goes back several millennia. So these are performers who are just really, when they come together, will wow audiences. And part of what they do is they take traditional Chinese music, but are known for innovating within it and giving it a contemporary feel. So it's taking what's the roots of the music and pushing it in new directions.
Well, let's take a look at this unusual music. To turn to South America and something that actually comes out of the Andes with, I guess it's the Four Lopez brothers. Tell me a little bit about this music and how it originates.
Sure. So the, as you noted, this is a group, the Four Lopez brothers, and they perform as Andes Manta. And now they're based in the Hudson Valley in New York State. But they grew up in Ecuador. Their family hails from the village of San Gabriel, but they had moved to Quito, one of the urban centers in there, in the Andes. But the family would go back to regularly to the village of San Gabriel and made sure to nurture in their four sons, the Lopez brothers, a deep appreciation for this traditional music and playing at an early age. Talking about the music, what you're talking about are really distinctive sounds played on flutes and panpipes and also a series of small guitars like the charango and the bandolin and some handheld percussion instruments. This is music that was closely tied to life cycle celebrations, annual calendar-based ritual celebrations. So this could include dance rhythms played more so on the stringed instruments where they come to the fore, or very haunting melodies on the panpipes that call to mind the sort of environment and geography of the highlands. So this was the music that had been very deeply cultivated in the brothers by their parents. And then at a very early age, they showed quite an aptitude for playing it, became known for it, especially Fernando, who's sort of the de facto group leader. and were celebrated for sort of what they were going to be able to do to preserve and take this music in new directions.
And it looks as if it's sort of a blend of a pre-Columbian Catholic rituals, sort of animate dance. I mean, there's a rich history that seems to come not only after Columbus, but even before.
Yeah, so I mean, what's so empowering and encouraging, encouraging is probably a better word, about this is just like you noted, it's a tradition that predates the arrival of Europeans, of colonial contact in South America, and managed to survive that, when a lot of cultural traditions were suppressed by the Catholic Church. Instead, this is one that managed to survive and combine elements of that. So a lot of the celebrations and life cycle celebrations we were talking about, those really predate the Catholic Church, but like happened in so many areas of the Americas and the Caribbean and Cuba and Haiti, and here we're talking about South America and Ecuador, of course, was a sort of a process of syncretism, or where the cultural traditions were merged, so they were able to combine some of their indigenous traditions with aspects of the Catholic faith that had come in, and to keep those going, but sort of as a new cultural combination.
Let's take a little of that. I want to turn to something that's probably a little more used to American ears, and that, of course, is Irish music, the Greenfields of America. Tell me a little bit about that and the fact that this is really sort of trying to disseminate Irish culture, to share it with students, to share it with the world.
Yeah, Radley, Greenfields of America is one of the most accomplished and acclaimed performing ensembles in Irish music in the Americas. It was a group that has always, central to the group is Mick Maloney, who founded it originally in the mid-1970s. And what this group is really about at its core is celebrating and bringing together the best Irish-American, the best immigrant musicians who came to America and created a new repertoire here, by drawing on the diverse musical traditions of Ireland and bringing them together and celebrating what they were able to do in Irish communities here in the States. The other thing that really drove Mick's vision for this group was putting on stage, the idea that you could put on the concert stage at the same time Irish vocal, musical, and dance traditions. So it's this wonderful ensemble that you have, the great body of Irish song being preserved alongside some of the premier instrumentalists in the tradition, and then step dance. So it's a real experience for the senses. And, talking about these great musicians, first you have Mick, who is renowned for what he did for the tenor banjo, bringing it back as a big part of Irish music. He was born originally in County Limerick, came to the U.S., and it was through his involvement in the Festival of American Folklife that this group really emerged. And the other real all-star player in the group is coming out of Baltimore. Again, so proud to have another Marylander at the festival. And this is Billy McComiskey, who is one of the best accordion players in the world. He won an All-Ireland Championship. And both he and Mick are recipients of the National Heritage Fellowship, which is the highest honor for folk and traditional arts in the United States.
Let's hear a little. Thank you. There's another name here, Daryl Davis. He's a blues musician, a boogie-woogie piano, but also known to establish dialogues with the members of the Ku Klux Klan, even getting some of them to leave. And he talks about blues as has to offer truth, that the real people singing about real things and real situations. Tell me a little bit about, obviously, his background, but also his music.
Sure. I mean, Daryl is a really interesting and idiosyncratic figure in the best sense of the word, in that he doesn't fit into boxes, which makes him really exciting and a real pleasure to work with. IQ reference, if you ever look up Daryl, one of the first things you're going to find is his very conscious effort to engage with members of the Ku Klux Klan and get them to convert, but through dialogue. So it's so interesting, but he does something. I don't want to say similar, because that what he's doing there is so powerful, but he likes to cross boundaries as well musically. So, Daryl grew up, he was born in Chicago, and of course when people think of Chicago, they think of blues and post-World War II blues and Muddy Waters and the great migration of African Americans from the South that brought blues to Chicago. And that definitely was a big part of Daryl's formation and as a musician. But his parents, one of his parents worked for the Foreign Service, so he traveled the world, but he had that early musical introduction and took an interest in piano styles. But there were piano styles that were invented far before he was born, so he would teach himself and learn by listening to music, but he also sought out his musical heroes to learn from them directly. So that included Pine Top Perkins, the great pianist and boogie-woogie pianist who played with Muddy Waters, but also Johnny Johnson, who was the pianist with Chuck Berry. And that kind of gets to where Daryl starts to cross boundaries a bit, because, sure, I mean, blues and R&B and boogie-woogie were hugely important, but he was also a big fan of early rock and roll that Chuck Berry really stands for, and rockabilly music. So as much as Daryl really speaks to how music doesn't fit neatly in the categories of African American traditions and Anglo American traditions or whatnot, he's always about finding the similarities there, and those similarities are very much there in those musics. They come from the same roots, and we're drawing on the same influences, and so he sort of pulls all of that in his performance. So at this festival, he's going to perform solo. He's going to perform with Lafayette Gilchrist, a great jazz pianist from Baltimore, but he's also going to perform a few times with Bill Kirchin, the great Telecaster guitarist. So you're going to see all the different flavors that Daryl can bring to his to one of his sets at this year's festival.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the piano there. Few minutes we have left here. Let's take a look at some of the other groups. There's San Simon, I think it's called. It's a Bolivian group. Tell me a little bit about them.
Sure. So Tinku San Simon is a group from Arlington, Virginia, and they're going to be leading the festival's kickoff parade this year. Arlington is home to a very large Bolivian community, the largest of any U.S. state, about 30,000. In the last census, and so you have Bolivian restaurants and just all kinds of influences and a presence they brought to the cultural landscape. But one of these are the great parade, the dance and parade traditions, where you have these cultural fraternities who practice different traditional Bolivian dances, but use those as the building blocks of a parade that's led by a truck with music sort of thumping out of the back. And Tinku San Simon practices the Tinku dance, which has roots in ritualized combat to resolve conflicts, but now is part of a celebration of cultural identity through these parades. So it's a very colorful and athletic tradition that shows where how it started as a form of ritualized combat and the nature of the movements, but now makes for what's going to be a very exciting and vibrant and colorful and unique kickoff to this year's festival.
And then we have, along those lines, we have Drums But No Guns, percussion ensemble.
Sure. So this is one of the groups. Caroline, at the top of our conversation, referenced the family area. Drums No Guns is a group that's going to be performing both in the family area and in the street performance area. We're really happy and to have that part of the festival again this year. It's so important to have those street performances and the interactive performances in the family area. Drums No Guns was founded by Ram Bhagat. He lives in Richmond. Due to some early experiences in his both in his family and then as he was a teacher in high school with gun violence impacting his brother and then some of his students, he formed Drums No Guns to really promote and spread a message of peaceful problem solving and to promote youth nonviolence through finding this common human element with rhythm and percussion and what that gets at. But also it's about developing creativity in kids, so taking something like a bucket and turning that into a drum orchestra. So he's going to be doing participatory bucket drumming workshops in the family area once each day for kids to come and join and to sort of tap into that creative moment. And also in the in the street performance area with his small ensemble, they'll be setting up sort of a mini bucket drumming orchestra for to capture the roots of bucket drumming as a street tradition.
And we also have Pin Lions, which is a Chinese lion dance. Is it going to be colorful?
Yeah, this is another group that's going to be both in the family area and in the street performance area, and they're coming out of the University of Pennsylvania, and it's what they carry on is the Chinese lion dance tradition. Like you said, it's extremely colorful. This is one of the most ancient traditions in Chinese culture. It's tied in Chinese martial arts and kung fu in terms of the movement of the steps, and there's many origin stories depending on which style of Chinese lion dance for how it came about, but it's often tied to the influence and heritage of and importance of Buddhism in Chinese history. So it's coming out of that. And it's all about, especially heavily associated with Lunar New Year, and about spreading joy and prosperity and good luck at these important occasions and other things like restaurant openings or weddings. So that's everything it comes to symbolize. And what's really interesting about this group is I think it really speaks to how on-campus cultural organizations are really a place where students with shared heritage come together and nurture and cultivate and carry on cultural traditions. So this is a group at the University of Pennsylvania that's won a number of awards now and has really helped the students on campus there come together and grow together with that shared heritage and carry on the Chinese lion dance tradition.
In a few seconds we have left, also we have this Punch and Judy Puppetry show. Tell me just briefly about that.
Of course, gladly. Punch and Judy, it's a tradition that goes all the way back to the Italian Commedia dell'arte in the 16th century, makes its way to England, where it became street performance theater, and then came over to the States, of course, like so much with the British influence on the States. And it's a tradition that has deep roots in Maryland, going back to the American Revolution, especially the first performance was in Annapolis, but especially in Baltimore. And this particular performer, Professor Horn's Punch and Judy show, is carrying on a tradition that has a history over 100 years old. He's a real Baltimore institution. We're thrilled to have him. And just to tell you a bit about the tradition itself, the main figure is Punch, who comes out of the Punchinello in the Italian tradition, a trickster figure who's always getting in trouble, dragging his long-suffering wife, Judy, along on his escapades. But it's all about sort of deflating the pompous and inverting social structure. So as much as Punch is always, you always feel like he's not going to get out of it, he always does. And by the end, he's kind of flipped the scales, so to speak, on the figures of authority who are part of the show with him. So it's just going to be hilarious. And kids are going to love it, and they can see it in the family area and at street performances.
Josh also mentioned, by the way, and just briefly, that there will be some panel discussions. I know that Caroline wanted us to mention that. And if so, if you go down there, and as a matter of fact, I've seen a number of them when I was down there last time, and they're really interesting to see people talk about those traditions. We got to leave it there. Caroline O'Hare, the local manager for the festival. Also, Blaine Wade, he's the associate director for the National Council for the Traditional Arts. Appreciate you both taking time to talk to us, and we'll see you down at the festival.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.